Welcome, everyone, to Wise Talk. This is Mariposa's Monthly Leadership Forum. Today, we're excited to have Phil Jones. Phil is highly regarded as one of the world's leading sales trainers. He's a best-selling author and one of the most sought-after speakers across the world. From training more than 2 million people across 5 continents and 56 countries to coaching some of the biggest brands in the world, Phil's mission is to teach the world to sell, as resulted in his expertise being globally recognized. In 2013, he won the British Excellence in Sales and Marketing Award for Sales Trainer of the Year, the youngest ever recipient of that award and honor. He's also written 5 international best-selling books, including this month's leadership resource, Exactly What to Say, The Magic Words for Influence and Impact. And he's developed a number of online trainings courses that have enrolled tens of thousands of people across the globe. We found him on Twitter, and you can too. He's at Phil M. Jones UK. You can also find him on his website, and that's philmjones.com. So, Phil, thank you so much for joining us today from New Jersey. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Yeah. So, as I often do, when we've been doing this for about 15 years, so every month, so I always have the same question, which is that I'd like you to tell us about your journey and why you decided to write this particular book, Exactly What to Say. So talk about
okay.
it.
Okay.
Yeah, talk about I'll that.
Tell you, so my journey in business across the board, or my journey just related towards the book?
Well, I think that you've written a bunch of books, so maybe relate it to this particular book. I know it's pretty specific, so it'd be interesting to hear about why you decided to write this book.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I've been in business for quite some time. So I started when I was just 14 years of age. And my first business had me knocking on the doors of my neighbors, just asking them quite politely whether they would be interested in having their cars washed. And some said yes, some said no. And most just asked me how much money I would charge, which I very quickly realized meant they were remarkably interested, providing my prices were reasonable. And I did okay with this little car cleaning business, so much so that by the age of 15, I wasn't going to school quite as often as I should. And
yes.
I remember being invited in by my school teachers, questioning my attendance, and asking me, Phil, why don't I come to school? And I responded to them. I said, sir, do you mind me asking you a question? Teacher said, yeah, sure, go for it. And the question I asked was, how much money are you making? School teacher refused to tell me at the time, but at 15 years of age, my little car cleaning business was delivering around £2,500 a month, so around $4,000 at the time.
Wow.
And the reason I didn't go to school, I guess, is that I had staff that needed direction, customers that needed servicing, things that needed to get done. So I started out in this whole game ridiculously early. When I look back on it now in hindsight, crazy, crazy learning early. And since that point in time, I've now been the youngest ever sales manager for one of the biggest department stores in the world. I was head of sales training, learning and development director for one of the largest furniture retail businesses, head of retail, commercial director for 2 Premier League soccer clubs, built a giant property business that turned over £240 million at its peak. And then since starting this training business, and now a decade ago, I've trained over 2 million people. And one of the things that has always been a commonality through all of those roles is that the difference between those that win and those that really win are that the ones that really win, they know exactly what to say, when to say, and how to make it count. They know the power of words at the right time. And this has fascinated me from day one. The ability that we can have to negotiate and influence, the ability that we can have to be able to move, drive, or control a conversation merely based on the words that we use. And the study that I've gone through over this period, both from the experience of mine and the experience I've gathered from others, is that success in these areas leaves a lot of clues. And the book that I've created in Exactly What to Say is an amalgamated, distilled version of success language that helps people control conversations more freely in the shortest big book I could possibly write.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, tell us a little bit about the magic here with some of these words. Tell us a little bit about how these words could be empowering, and if you could share an example or two or some stories.
Sure. I mean, firstly, let's understand what magic words really are. Firstly, magic words aren't necessarily anything that's magic, just like magic isn't magic. But what they are words that talk straight towards the subconscious brain. Subconscious brain is powerful, particularly in the decision-making process, because in the subconscious there is a yes and a no, there is no maybe. And it is indecision that causes the biggest challenge and the biggest breakdown when you're trying to get people to change, or you're trying to influence somebody to be able to do something different or buy something. So if you can talk to the part of somebody's brain that is completely free of indecision, then what can happen is we can assist that decision-making process more effortlessly, more easily. So the magic words that are listed in the book are examples that talk straight towards that very given situation. There are things that we can do to move people to action and to free down some of that friction that typically comes in conversation. So I guess if we're going to reach for some examples, we may as well start somewhere near the beginning. And one of the biggest barriers that I found that people would often have when trying to suggest a new idea to somebody, whether that idea was for them to buy something or to do something, is that they were fearful in some way of rejection. They're fearful that they're going to get some form of negativity back in the other direction. So they don't ask for the things that they would want in life or ask for the action they're looking for from the other person because they're fearful they might say no. So I figured if I can help them create a rejection-free opening formula that could allow them to introduce just about anything to just about anybody without that fear of rejection, then they'd be able to ask for the things they want in life more freely. And I learned that if you were to preface your idea with the words, "I'm not sure if it's for you," then what would happen by presenting an idea to somebody using those words, the little voice inside the other person's head, their subconscious brain, does two things. When I say, "I'm not sure if it's for you," the little voice firstly says, "I'll be the judge of that." So it decides instantaneously that it has a decision to make. But secondly, curiosity is piqued. And when you say, "I'm not sure if it's for you," they think, "Well, what is it? What is the it that we're talking about here?" And they lean in and they want to know more. Now, we back this up with a further three-letter word that changes, again, the tonality and the activeness of the language. See, if I put the three-letter word "but" on the end of this, we all know what "but" does in any form of normal conversation. See, if somebody was in maybe an employed position somewhere and their boss said to them, "Hey, I love everything you do here. You're a really valuable member of the team. That we know you're trying your very best, but," the only thing we would then end up remembering is everything that follows the "but." So the "but" negates whatever was said prior to it. What this means is if we want to present an idea to somebody and we say, "I'm not sure if it's for you, but," you wouldn't happen to know, or "I'm not sure if it's for you, but," you wouldn't happen to have a few moments for me to share some ideas with you, the little voice in the other person hears, "You might want to look at this." So there's one simple example of the 20 plus examples that comes out in the book.
Yeah, I like that one. I mean, I'm looking at the list right now, and so I wanna bring up a few other ones if you don't mind.
anywhere you want to go, we're good. I promise. Anyway.
Talk to me and us about the idea of you have three options. So I think people like choice. So if you give them choice, then less chance for them to reject. And by the way, what you're trying to do with both of these is you're trying to like deal with people's resistance. You're trying to deal with with smart people have resistance, and you're trying to diminish it, not eliminate it, because I don't think eliminate is too strong, but diminish their resistance. Okay.
All we're looking to try to do here is to make decision making easier. That's it. Mm-hmm. We're not trying to manipulate anybody into any way that's unethical. We're not looking to be able to try and force somebody to do something they didn't want to do. We're just looking to ease their decision-making process. And to me, a huge part of what being a great salesperson is to be a decision catalyst or a professional mind-maker-upper. That's what our job is. It isn't necessarily...
mind-maker-upper, I like it.
Well, it is what we do, right? I don't mind me and my clients.
That's a good one.
You know, even if people choose no, indecision is where people get stuck. So if we take the example, you have three options. What we're doing is we're playing towards the other person's psychology of the fact that they are making the final decision. They're not being forced into anything. That what they're not doing is they're not doing anything they don't want to do. Take, say, for example, when you go to a dinner event in a corporate setting, and you're being asked what you want for dinner, and you've got three options, how much easier does decision-making become? Versus the alternative of being faced with the Cheesecake Factory menu.
Oh, my God.
Well, you need to take a week off of work just to figure out what you might want to eat, right? When there's too many choices. And in life, there are so many choices. So when we can take the ability in conversation with others and help them work through their choices by minimizing them and then putting them into buckets, what we can do is we can allow them to be able to choose more easily. We can even be more intelligent with that by presenting three options without there actually being three options. So I can stack or weight how I guess
right.
each of those three options to allow
right.
somebody to choose more freely. So an example might look something
like you're gonna go for,
So you can say, look, the way I see it, you have three options. You can do nothing. You can continue to do what you've always done, expect different results, but know that nothing's going to change. You can continue to maybe look through the rest of the market, trying to find another supplier that could do this, knowing that what's going to happen is there's going to be wasted time every step along the way. Or you could trust us with this, knowing that we've got decades of experience of doing a great job for others, all safe in the knowledge that if we do not deliver to our promise, that you've got 100% money-back guarantee. I mean, the choice is yours.
Okay, so interesting, because when I was thinking about the three options, I was thinking about when you're proposing something, so when you're selling, you're proposing something, and you're giving them three options so they feel like they have choice for even like
mm-hmm.
like when people are choosing coaches, you know, we'd like to give them two so they feel like they have choice, so they're not stuck with something. And when
right.
we're giving them three options as far as a program, we're giving them that because we want them to feel like they're empowered. It's like an empowerment. Thing. So they get to choose, and all we may have a particular one we think is best, but that one might be too expensive. So we give
right.
them a lower, yeah. So is that some of what you're talking about when you're talking about three options, or is that something different?
There's an element of difference in that, is the giving people three options when the three options are equally weighted actually makes the decision-making process harder. So think
yeah.
of it sometimes, you know, if you were presented with three bottles of wine and you didn't know much about wine and they were all of a similar price point, then what we've now got here is we've got, I don't know which one to pick. I've got to lean on some form of previous experience. Which one do I like the label of? Which one's got a name on it that I may have heard before?
Mm-hmm.
Or
yeah.
what often happens here in a service-based environment is you'll push back to the server or the sommelier, et cetera, and say, which one do you recommend? And they'll ask you another simple question of, like, do you like bold flavors or do you like lighter? And you'll say, I like lighter. And they say, well, you want this one. So they make the process remarkably easy. The risk you can have sometimes when you give somebody three options is you actually abdicate yourself from the decision-making process, and you're saying it's now over to you. And one of the biggest reasons that many an organization gives three options is because they don't like having the price-based conversation with the customer. So what they do is they say, here are three options. You pick how much you want to pay. The risk is if you give somebody three options at three different price points, what you're actually saying is all three of these will work. My recommendation is you could take these pills, or these pills. If that came to you from a doctor,
right.
you'd be thinking,
right.
Might need to change my doctor. Whereas,
back to your wine example. So if I'm asking the sommelier which one, the first thing he should ask me, or I'll say to him, at this price point. In other words, he could give me like, you know, three options, one of them being $100, one of them being $70, one of them being $50, and I
right.
really was only going to spend $70. I don't want to spend $100. So it's $100
yeah.
out. So to me it's more analogous to say, I want you to give me three choices in this price point.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. But what we often want though is we want an expert opinion. See, we do like to be led if we trust the source that is leading us.
Yes.
So what I would rather have is instead of having three options, I would rather have somebody ask me some questions. The ultimate goal that we should have as an expert in any line of work is that we should be able to make our best recommendation as our first move towards anything. Now, we can give somebody a choice of three if our best recommendation is outside of their expense or outside of their budget. But what we should be saying, first of all, is because of the fact that you said, because of the fact that you said that you like coastal wines from Sonoma County and that you'd like something big and fruity and you don't want to spend anything more than $70, my best recommendation is this one.
Yeah.
But we've got to be able to say it's because of the fact that you said X, Y, and Z that what we recommend is A, B, and C. Now what we're doing is recommending things for other people's opinions. The alternative is let's look at these three options. Let me tell you everything about these three options. And the result of that can actually be that we confuse the buyer as opposed to assist their buying process, because now they're having to learn a load of stuff that they didn't realize they needed to learn. They were just thirsty and wanted a drink.
So along those, so let's take, this is a great example of the wine. So let's say that we go with that, and he really likes the he wants to upsell me, the 100,
okay.
because he wants to make more money, but also because he really thinks it's a better wine.
Okay.
So
well, let's take it because he thinks it's a better wine, not because he wants to make more money, and that he thinks that the customer will be happy with the choice.
Right.
So you're thinking about how we might better get him to consider maybe looking at something that is slightly more than the sum of money that she laid down.
Exactly.
She said she didn't want to spend more than 70.
Which is what happens a lot in our business, and I'm sure in yours and a lot of people in service business,
yeah.
where they think they can only spend, I'm making this up, let's actually call it 50,000, 70,000.
Well, let's keep it with the wine.
They can only spend 70, and we want them to spend 100 because it's better for them. Go ahead.
Right. So what we're going to do, we can do it with a 70 and the 100. We can do it with 70,000. We can do it with 100,000.
Whatever.
Or anywhere we like with the pricing. But if we
right.
take it with the wine, and we can now come back with a question. I know that you say $70 is what you want to spend, but if I could show you something that was 100 that I think would blow your mind and give you more than you could ever bargain for, would you want to see that and be aware of that in the choice process, or do you want to stick to anything that's 70 or less?
Awesome. That's great. See? That's awesome.
Right? So, but what we're doing is we're giving them choice every time. And the key thing for us to understand, and you should have got this as a thread through the entire book in Exactly What to Say, is that the person who's in control of the conversation is the one who's asking the questions, not the one that's giving the answers. And too many people fall foul of when a question is being asked of them, they feel that they're obligated to give an answer. Now, I'm sure many of the people in right now, in the call right now, are married. Let's just take marriage for example. The moment when somebody proposes to somebody, do you believe that in that moment they're wishing, hoping, and praying they're going to say yes? Or do you believe that they're pretty darn certain?
They better be, yeah. I think that they'd be
pretty
right. darn certain they're going to say yes. Yes.
And that's the level that we should be looking to get to before we make a bold recommendation to a client to do something, is that same level of near certainty that we believe that this is right. What happens is people tend to peak too soon, download features and benefits over somebody, and hope that some of that's going to stick. Instead, if we just ask 2 to 3 more questions, we gather enough evidence to earn the right to recommend a solution mm-hmm. that the other person believes because we know enough about their circumstances to make that recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
If in that
yeah.
scenario with the wine, the lady came back to me and said, look, $70 is all I've got. It's cash within my purse right now. I can't go a penny over and I don't carry credit
exactly.
cards, but I'd really like a bottle of wine. We show her the best $70 wine.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. This is great. I love it. I love it. I love it. All right, let me take one more on your list and I'm going to open it up because I'm sure people have, have questions about it or have their own situation, their own bottle of wine. scenario. By the way, I never spent $100 on a bottle of wine. there's no way. let's see. Let's take just out of curiosity. I love that one. Let's talk about that.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the worst objection in the world. The worst objection in the world in all of our lines of business is when somebody says back to you the words, I just need some time to think about it. Now, when we receive those words, I just need some time to think about it, we are pretty certain they're not telling us the truth. You know, we're pretty certain they're not going to go home and do a SWOT analysis about whether they shall or shan't move forward with a decision or invite their friends around and do a pros and cons. What they're really saying to you is, I'm pushing this decision away for another day. I can't deal with it right now. And in my mind, that is slightly unfair when we've tried to have an honest and upfront conversation in the first instance. And chances are, in many scenarios, when somebody comes out to you and says, I need some time to think about it, what's happened prior to that point in time is they asked for your help or showed interest in your expertise. You've gone through a series of questions of getting to be able to understand them. You've put time, effort, energy, and expertise into learning about their situation, their issues, their challenges. What you've then done is you've given them a precise blueprint of exactly how you can help them overcome the things that they asked for your help for in the first place. And then at that precise moment in time, when you've given them that blueprint and explained to them how they can move forward with it, they say they need some time to think about it. Now, in my mind, that's not fair. Because in my mind, what happens when somebody says that to me is it makes me want to think or say back to them, like, what is it? Like, what is it you want to think about it? Because if you can tell me, I can probably help. But we don't say things like that because that's rude and obnoxious. And we're not rude and obnoxious people. So we end up saying things like, it's okay, I'll leave it with you. We're ready when you're ready, no pressure. Those are the things that get said back. And the result of which is we lose complete control of the scenario because we don't want to become pushy, one of the things that everybody hates about a salesperson. So we leave the ball in the other person's court, and that decision just remains on the shelf until some other external factor pushes it somewhere near the top again. My belief in these scenarios is that the other person owes us some honesty. They don't need to buy, they don't need to move forward, they don't need to take the action that we're asking to take, but they do need to tell us where they're at. I believe that level of truth is important. So I wanted to be able to ask these rude, obnoxious questions of people, but I didn't want to be rude and obnoxious. So to get around this, I learned another set of magic words. I learned that if I preface a direct question with the words just out of curiosity, not only can I ask whatever on earth I like, I can also turn rude and obnoxious into soft and fluffy.
Yeah.
So now what I could do when somebody says, I need some time to think about it, I could say, so just out of curiosity, what is it specifically you need some time to think about? Zip it. I could then remain silent. Or I could perhaps just nudge a touch further. I could say, just out of curiosity, what is it that would need to happen for you to make a decision over something like this? Zip it. Or I could really push. I could say, just out of curiosity, what is it that's stopping you from making a decision over something like this right now? Zip. And now the silence becomes my friend. One of two things will happen during said silence. Either about 12 seconds goes by, which feels like about 3 weeks. It really does. It feels like 3 weeks. And during which period of time they come back with some honesty, some real answer. You know, I don't have that kind of money, or when I started down this journey, you know, I had this thought in mind, but now I've completely changed my mind because I'm over here. They come back and they tell you the truth, and from that you can do something with it. But if it's not 12 seconds and it's 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, this is good news. It means they're hunting for an excuse and they cannot find one. And because they cannot find an excuse, it means it empowers them to go on to be able to make the decision that you both knew was right in the first place. And it's the ability to be able to ask big, brave, bold questions like that, remain quiet enough for long enough for the other person to find out that they don't have an excuse, that allows you to add the job title, professional mind maker upper, to your resume.
Mm-hmm. Okay, awesome. This is great. All right, let's open up the line. And most of the people on the call are in high tech, and they're coaches, they're managers, consultants. Most are here, but some are all over. So who has a question? If you could say your name and then ask Phil a question or a comment.
Maybe we have everybody lost the word, Sue.
I don't know. Just out of curiosity, what's stopping you as you're talking?
Hi, Sue. This is Lisa. I have
Lisa.
A question.
Yay. Hi, Lisa.
So a lot of the people that I work with could apply this in situations where they're trying to persuade others within a company. So you're often in these, you know, big conference rooms with the full executive team, and you've come up with a path for your strategy that you think the company ought to move towards, or recommendation on a product roadmap or whatever, and you're trying to persuade the organization. So do you feel like these types of words and phrases would be helpful in those situations as well, or do you think there needs to be some modification?
The principles that apply to every set of words here are useful in situations providing one thing is true. And one thing always has to be true, that we are looking to influence people and not robots. So providing we are looking to be able to move people towards action, the words work, or certainly the principles behind the words work. And there is nothing that I share in a book of this kind of nature, or nothing that I've shared on this call, that will work with all of the people all the time. There is no magic pill that way around. But what we do have here is simple sequences of words that work with more of the people more of the time. So if you've got a set of circumstances where you're looking to be able to move a giant pack of people, then by weaving word choices into your story form presentations, what you'll have is more people seeing for themselves what it is that you're saying. And if they can see for themselves what it is that you're saying, then they can start to accept that to be true as their idea. The minute they start to accept it to be true as their idea, Now no longer does it require you to suggest, persuade, or influence them into being able to think that way, because they are already thinking that way. Therefore, they're in agreement with you. Therefore, they're on your side. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's really helpful, because I work with a lot with, you know, in the tech industry, and you're often in these meetings where you're trying to convince people to move in a certain direction, and generally these types of people are not effective salespeople. So I think this could be really, this book could be really helpful for them.
Yeah, and take a situation like that where you've got people in the meeting room and you're trying to be able to influence what people are thinking. You can put it out there to a group is, look, the way I see it right now, we have three options. You know, we could do this, we could do this, or we could do what I've been telling you that we should be doing for the last, right? And by laying out the fact that there are three options, now you've put fences around the freedom that they had and said, you've got to pick a team. So you're either in the we're doing nothing lane, we're going to procrastinate forever lane, or the we're going to move forward with Lisa's idea lane. So which one's going to be easier for you? And note that there's another set of words in the book that is a beautiful set of closing lines following the you've got three options. And it's the set of words, which one's going to be easier for you? Not which one would you like to do, which one's going to be easier for you? So the minute that we ask that question, what we've done is we've created movement in our language. We've created fluidity in the outcome. And we know this is an action or an outcome-focused conversation. This isn't a tactical review or a strategic point in time that we're looking at. This is something that requires decision, therefore movement. Therefore, it means something needs to happen, and you need to decide.
You follow, Lisa?
Got it. Thank you.
Yes,
got it. Thank you.
Do you have a follow-up question or something? Okay.
I have a follow-up question. Not related.
Okay.
Different person, but still a follow-up question.
Who is this?
Hi, my name's Ellen. And my
Hi,
Ellen.
What if people really do have three options? And we'll just use a common example, like you've got Coke, Pepsi, or RC Cola.
Okay.
So I guess maybe you could give some tips on how you could get someone to choose your option when they literally do have three options.
Absolutely. So what you've got now is we now need to be able to move people through some kind of different level of elimination. So we could suggest that when somebody has three options, all options are equal, but you and I both know, Ellen, that's not true, right? All options aren't equal. You give me Coke, Pepsi, and what was the third one?
RC Cola.
Okay. Who are you and which one do you want people to pick?
Oh, well, clearly I would choose Coke.
Okay. And what am I looking to get? What am I looking to try and get people to do here? Am I looking to try and get people to consider Coke and they're currently a Pepsi user? Or am I looking to get people that could be a Coke or a Pepsi user that have never had the experience of RC Cola? Which one am I looking to get?
I guess for the sake of the example and for all the listeners, I would just say, let's say you're trying to convert someone to your product. So we'll say they currently drink Pepsi, but you'd like them to drink Coke.
Okay. Now, as a Coke drinker, as a Coke drinker, the way that I see it is that you have three options. You can drink, as a cola drinker, sorry, the way I see it is you can have three options. You could drink Coke, you could drink Pepsi, or you could drink RC Cola.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most people that decide to choose to drink Pepsi find out not only do they enjoy the taste more, but also they enjoy the benefit of the fact that it's 2 cents a can cheaper that results in them being better off over an annual period of time off. So see what I've done here is I've said that the three options are equally weighted, and then I've said that most people that choose the option that I want them to choose find these benefits as a result of which.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've now done is I've lifted one out of the three and make it look like the obvious choice.
Okay.
So that would be one of a thousand strategies that we could use to achieve the same. But the power in that is the words most people.
Most people choose is the magic word. Okay. Can I ask one more question, or do you want to give everybody else?
Go ahead. Go for it.
Okay. You made a statement earlier that I really think is profound and obviously true. Is the person in charge of the conversation is the one asking the questions. And I am guilty as charged. I have not read your book, but I'm wondering, is there a section in the book or a list of great probing or guiding questions in the book, or do you have some that you'd like to share now?
Well, the book itself is a book of great probing questions. Almost everything listed in the book is a preface to a question that is then backed up with examples. And the format of the book also is, I learned that people like you are not very good at reading books. I learned that to be true.
I'm good at it. I just don't do it.
Right. So maybe good at buying them, maybe good at being able to read them, but actually taking the time to prioritize it as something to do is something that we are not so good at when we're busy people, right? There's other stuff to be done. So my ultimate goal in writing this book was to write a book that was readable. So can we get cover to cover on it within maybe an hour, hour and 15 minutes? Is it a format that is digestible and instantly applicable so you can take what you've learned and use it? That's what I worked real hard to do. So the setup of the book is a set of words, a base understanding of the principle as to where that comes from and why it works, and then 3 to 5 examples of those words in action. Most of the words in the book are prefaces to questions. The examples are obviously the words used alongside a question, but it's designed with the purpose of allowing the other person to open up the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
The ultimate goal that we should get to as questioning is to realize that if the other person says it, it must be true, whereas if you say it, it might not be. The goal we should be looking to get is whatever we want to prove to be true in a negotiation, our goal is to get that evidence to come from the other person's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't for us to tell somebody something. So for anybody who's a parent on the call right now, you'll know this to be true in a parenting capacity, is that what you need is that you need to ask questions of your children to help them realize what they've done that was right or wrong, as opposed to tell them off for the thing they've done wrong. The acceptance of the idea changes, and the responsibility towards the outcome changes too. We never grew out of that. Adults are the same way too, and we should be looking to be able to color it in with questions. And you might well be great at asking questions, perhaps. You just might have to ask a couple more before you jump to a conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want some specifics, these things aren't in the book, but
yeah.
These are precise words that you can use to get other people to talk about themselves more often and sell themselves into what it is that you would like them to do. And they are words like, uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Really? Wow. Cool. See, any of those suggestive noises, nudges, nods, or encouragements for other people to continue talking about themselves, result in them coloring in more of their side of the fence that earns you more of the right to make the recommendation you'd like them to follow later on in the conversation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I love that, going back to what you said, and I didn't want to fade away, but this is, because some people coming into the call might think, oh, this is a little manipulative, but I think if we continue to hold the mindset of this is helping people make decision-making easier.
Correct.
I love that. It's so simple. This is about decision-making. It's about influencing decisions. And it's choice of words that help us. And I think my belief about selling is that we're dealing with people's resistance. So you just have to figure out where the resistance is and ask them the questions to get to a different place. And so this is what you're really helping us do, which I appreciate.
And the issue with these thoughts around manipulation, too, is manipulation would result in the other person feeling manipulated at the end of it.
That's right.
And it would result in the other person waking up the next day and thinking, oh, I've just made a bad decision. Now, if that's the case, in 2018 and onwards, that is not a good business strategy, right? Like, this is going to come out in the wash. You're not going to have a long-term profitable relationship. You're not going to be able to go on and deliver the service with that individual that you would like. So, yes, everything I teach could be used for evil. Absolutely. However, if it is used for evil, it won't work. It really won't. It won't for long, because what will happen is it won't get found out. What we're looking to be able to do through understanding success language is move more of the right people towards the right decision more quickly. The risk is right now, through not controlling conversations effectively, that people end up choosing your competitor that would have had a better job from choosing you, or choosing the wrong thing from you because you weren't brave enough to help them navigate towards the thing that was right. And that's the thing that I would live more in fear of, is that the people you knew you could help best, spending money on the wrong thing or spending time with the wrong people, all because of the fact that you couldn't help them with their decision-making process. That's what I live in fear of, more than fear of being manipulative.
Yeah. I'm with you. I just wanted to reiterate the the ease of decision making. I think that that's a nice.
I get passionate about this stuff. Is with a book of this nature, what can happen sometimes is people pick it up blind and jump to some of the wrong conclusions about where it's written from or what the point is. And I have a handful of 1-star Amazon reviews that get my goat on that a little and cause me a little friction when I realize, well, you've missed the point. That's not what it's about. But still, can't please all of the people all of the time.
Right. All right, let's talk about, again, I'm just going to keep using examples here because I think you're just so good at that. So let's talk about if I can, will you? So you give an example in here, if I can come down 10% of the price, can you complete the purchase today? So that's sort of a very typical get them while they're hot, you know, sales technique. And I'm sure there's more to it than that, so talk to us about that.
Yeah, what you have here is quite often people are asking you to move from your standard terms and conditions in some way, shape, or form, whether it's I want you to be cheaper, I want you to be quicker, I want you to include this, can you do it on a Tuesday, you know, whatever they are asking you to do that is moving away from your standard terms and conditions. If you automatically just say yes to this thing, what you've done is a disservice to the value proposition that you provide to everybody else that you ever do business with. The first thing that we should be looking to do when somebody asks you to move is to respond with a question in the other direction that puts you back in control and helps us understand what we're playing with, safe enough to allow them to be able to move. Mm-hmm. So if somebody asks me to move on price, or if somebody asks me if I can add extras or any of those things, so my response would be, if anybody was asking me to move, would be, if I can, will you? So if I can bring that price down to be able to meet this, then would you be in a position to move forward with the decision on this today? Now, what I do with a question or a response in that direction is, yes, I take control back, but also I find out what it is that we'd be needing to move around from. So say, for example, we had this bottle of wine, and I wanted them to do the $100 bottle. And they said, look, I can't go to anything more than $85. And I said, well, look, if I can do this for $85, this particular bottle of wine for you for $85, then would you sooner have this one as opposed to the $70 one you were looking at previously? Now I've got a yes-no scenario. Now, if the no comes in here and she says, well, to be fair, I've only got $70 anyway, so it's irrelevant, then I've now realized there's no point in me talking about discounting, adjusting, or changing any form of price towards the existing bottle because they only have $70. There's no point entering into a price-based negotiation if there is no more money available, right? Which is unfortunately what too many people do. It's like, I could do this for $85, but she's only got $70, so what's the point? However, if she says, yeah, sure, if you can do that for $85, I'll stretch to be to take on the luxury wine bottle today. Do I now have to sell it for $85? No, I don't. I just found out that if all things were equal, then she would rather step up to this one at $85. Now what I'm not doing is I'm not selling a $100 bottle of wine. Now what's left for me to be able to do is to sell a $15 difference between the $85 and the $100. You get what I'm saying? So I'm not selling 0 to 100. I'm selling 85 to 100. I'm selling the gap. So I can say, so what is it about this one that makes you now want to taste this wine more so than the one that you previously wanted? She's like, I've never had this one before. It sounds like it's a premium option. I've never spent that amount of money on wine. I'd love to find out, you know, how much more enjoyable it might be. Oh, and anything else? Well, based on what you've said and the fact that you only do have one bottle, I think that if I don't do it today, then chances are I might not be able to get the choice. Okay, and anything else? Well, I've just looked it up on Vivino, and it's got 5 stars, and everybody's raving about it. It sounds like I'd be an idiot to miss it. Right? So now what the other person has done is they validated the fact that the bottle of wine they do want is the $100 bottle of wine. So now we've shifted the conversation where it's not about price, it's about which bottle is your favorite. So now we can have a meaningful discussion about the fact of how do we get you into it. Well, unfortunately, my prices are fixed. $100 is $100, and if I do anything less than that, then what will happen is that I'm going to lose my job. But here's what I'm going to do. Do the bottle of wine that you would really like, the one that you really want. And what I will do as well is I'll pour you a glass of the other one, because we do have a bottle of that one that's open behind the bar. And what you can do is then you can really experience the better that you're getting from the wine. Does that make sense, or does that sound fair? So what happened is that started with the if I can, will you, Because what we had to realize was, is which bottle of wine did she want? Because if
yeah.
we don't know which one she really wants, regardless of price, then price is irrelevant.
Yeah, that's the one. What they need and want is huge. Yeah, that's for sure. Okay,
mm-hmm.
so this is great. So let's talk about something kind of riffing off what Lisa said. So you're in a meeting, and many meetings end with let's meet again, or let's I'll think but I'll think about it, or those types of scenarios. So talk to us about like the whole idea of what happens next. That's one of the magic words in here. I'll often say, well, what's the next steps? So there's always an action at the end, so that there's always a, moving the needle at the end. And I'm sure that I can get
okay.
much more confident about that. So what do you have to offer us in that regard? Because I'm sure you have some
okay.
great ideas.
Yeah, sure. And I think you're absolutely right here. A real commonality in business meetings across the board is that people sit and have a meeting or a discussion or a phone call or whatever it might be, and all of the information gets discussed and shared, and at the end of it, nobody knows what to do. It's kind of like, so, well, that was it then. Now what? And people are looking for leadership. Success in selling is about maintaining control of a conversation. We established that earlier on. So this is the most critical point of being able to lead something towards a predetermined outcome. Now, you know what you want to happen next, yes?
Mm-hmm.
In almost every scenario, you know what you would like that to be. Now, if you do anything other than assume that this is what happens next, what you're suggesting is that isn't what normally happens. Now, here's what could happen. Is when you say, well, so what's the next step? If you put it in question form, now what you've done is you've asked the other person to know what normal is here, and they don't.
Wait, would you say that? I didn't hear that last part. You put in a question.
So if you finish a meeting and you say, so what's the next step? You've asked the other person to take responsibility for what needs to happen from here. And if they're not an experienced buyer of your product or service, they're going to fall to a default position. And the default position for the majority of people is, well, can you send me a proposal? Have you got anything you can leave with me? Is there something I can take away today, or I need some time to think about it? You just laid them up for that.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't know what normal is in this environment because they're not an experienced buyer of it. What we should do here is we should take charge of the situation and we should lead it. And everybody should develop a what happens next situation. And this means when you get to the meat of the meeting and that you've gone through everything you need to go through, you just say, well, what happens next from here is. So what happens next from here is that you're going to make a decision now of which of the two programs is going to work best for you. We're going to then schedule in the date for us to be able to get started. And I currently have some availability in my calendar for early parts of next week, so Monday or Tuesday, when suits you best.
And that is could be presumptive.
Oh, it could
be. Ready.
But if you've gone through an hour's worth of conversation where they came to you with a need, requirement, or demand for the service that you provided, and you've just had an hour's worth of discussion explaining what it is that you do, and they nodded and smiled and grunted in all of the right places,
yeah.
then why would you not be assuming that that is what they wanted? Because, a doctor does this every time that you go, and they ask you some questions, understand your symptoms, and they find out what it is that's wrong with you, and then they then write you a script. They don't say, so what's your next step? Or they don't say, well, so what do you want to do then? They write you out a prescription, and they send you on your merry way, expecting you to go pick it up from the pharmacy. Because that's how experts behave, is that they actually make a set of recommendations, they prescribe their best recommendations, and they assume that people are going to take them, knowing that if they're over the age of 21, grown up enough to not like what it is that you're saying, they will tell you. They're allowed to say no still, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't show people what your version of normal looks like, then what they're going to have to do is to make it up by themselves, and the only version of normal that many people can revert to is, well, I need some time to think about it, or have you got a brochure?
So,
can you send me a proposal?
Yeah, so what you're suggesting is that you are presumptive and you would say, as the person that, it's not even so much the salesperson, but it could be just, you're trying to get your green light on your, proposal internally, something to the effect of, okay, so what happens next? Here's a scenario. You could use a scenario, or you could be more presumptive of saying, here's what happens next. I guess the question is how strong you would want to be in terms of presumption.
No.
Like,
Note the difference, though, between
that scenario instead of a scenario. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a difference between here's what happens next and what happens next is. See, if I say here's what happens next, what I'm doing is I'm lacing it with a level of control that says I'm going to tell you. The here's creates an emphasis of the fact that this is a non-negotiable. If
right.
I say what happens next is, then what I'm insinuating is this is what normal looks like. So I'm creating a majority of this is what normal is, and I'm still leaving room for them to be able to accept. If I say here's what happens next, I've made
it
an absolute.
I gotcha. Yeah, that's good. And the other way you could say is here's what could happen next, but that actually is too soft. Yeah, I see. So there's three different variety. Yeah, I gotcha.
And this is why precision in word choices is so important.
And that's the kind of stuff that drives me crazy. I know.
Another example with what happens next, though, could be as you're coming towards the end of a project. It could be, so what happens next on from here is I'm going to take away all the things that we found out today in the meeting. I'm going to write that up into a report. That's going to get maybe done back end of next week. I'm going to need to put that into this, 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 and this. I'm going to need to speak to this person here, and that should lead us through to being able to then execute the plan more professionally. So we're just using it to say, let's write the schedule of between this moment and the next action. So everybody's on the same page knowing what happens next. It's the indecision that happens that leaves everybody in fresh air. And this is what happens where lots of business doesn't get done. So you've just had a great meeting where somebody's super interested or excited about what you're about. They've just had a great meeting where they're super interested and excited about how you might be able to help them. And that you both leave the meeting thinking, I don't know what's going to happen next.
Mm-hmm.
That was an unsuccessful meeting if that was the case.
Right. Interesting. Yeah, it's the slight variation of what happens next with here's what happens next. Those are different.
Mm-hmm.
Because that word here sounds much more, it's too strong. Whereas what happens next allows them to, here is what, what you're trying to do is normalize what it is for most people. You're kind of going back to the idea of most people.
Correct.
The same principle applies. Same principle. Yeah. Interesting. Awesome. All right. Well, we have a couple more minutes. So, if anybody wants to jump on and paint a scenario and they want to get some help with, that's fine. And if you don't, that's okay too. We can finish up. These are really great. You can get these from the book. And does anybody have another scenario or question they'd like to ask Phil?
Why don't I just give an example based on something you're doing right now? when you want people to engage, which often we do,
one of the things
that is often said at the end of a meeting or an end of the discussion is, firstly, does anyone have any questions? Now, what that does is that gives everybody else other than you permission to go. Does that make sense? So if you're hearing that, everybody else can go ahead of you. Does anyone else have? So that's not do you have, that's does anyone have? So you're aiming a question at everybody other than the person that you want to listen to it in a group environment. The same thing that can happen with questions is that we get to an end of a sales presentation and we say, well, do you have any questions? Now, if we say, do you have any questions, what we're doing is we are suggesting the other person should have questions, and we're suggesting that what we have just delivered to them wasn't all of the information. So we actually create further indecision in the other person, rephrase the question to what questions have you got for me, for them to feel empowered to say I've got no questions, for them to then have told you they've got enough information to make a decision, which then earns you the right to be able to ask for it. So the phraseology of how we ask people for questions. In a group environment, rephrase it to what questions have you got for me, or who's got my first question, and what starts to happen is you...
Yeah.
What we've now done is we've removed the friction from a group conversation environment, and you get a higher level of engagement.
Nice. So what questions do you have for me? For Phil and for me? No takers, I get it. Okay. So, Phil, this has been great. I mean, really, I've been taking a lot of notes, and I typically take notes. I'm taking more notes than normal. Definitely want to shout out the book again, Exactly What to Say, The Magic Words for Influence and Impact. I do a lot of work on influence. I mean, I do with my clients, and I also speak a lot about influence. And I have to say that I feel that I have a lot to, you know, I always feel like I have a lot to learn, but I, based on this conversation, I feel like I really have a lot to learn. So you've enlightened me, and I really appreciate it. I know the people on the call do too. So
it's my pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me on the show.
Yeah, cheers to you. Real quick, our next Wise Talk is May 23rd. It's a Wednesday at 11 a.m., so same time. We have Stacey Hanke. She's the author of Influence Redefined, Be the Leader You Were Meant to Be. And, you know, as most of you know on the call, we, and most of you who are listening later, this year is all about influence. We pick a theme every year. We've been doing this for 15 years. And so we're really happy that Phil could join us and give us a lot of great, great tips. Go read his book, Exactly What to Say. Thanks, everybody, and we'll see you, hear you next month. Bye now.